session is called Threatening Deserts. Well, I thought I'd start out by asking you how many have been or have lived in, have been to a desert? Everyone here. Okay, well, you all know your deserts, I'm sure, but let's just point out some of the deserts and remember where the deserts are. Who can name some deserts? I'm not sure I know which continent there are.
The Sahara.
Okay, obviously the Sahara comes with all that. Sorry. Which desert?
Is it the Gobi Desert?
Where is the Gobi?
It's over in Mongolia.
Oh, okay. All right, so it's still, it's in that northern hemisphere kind of thing. Oh, up in the Mongolia. Okay.
So the Great American Desert.
Okay, so that, so.
And then the Chilean Peruvian Desert, which I've
been to too. Oh, wow. So that must be down here.
It's a, yeah, it's a pretty okay. much the whole southern. The coast of South America.
Yeah. Okay.
Carl, excuse me, that door.
He's
Carl, he's going.
Carl, can you just shut the door?
Oh, you're going in the door. Okay.
So. All right. As we know, the deserts, the band, it's really interesting that they're symmetrical around the equator. The band going across all of this part, and then most of Australia, and of course the Kalahari Desert down here, and down there. There are a lot of deserts in the world. I, of course, was never interested in deserts at all until I went to Senegal, south of the Sahara. But the more I think about it, the more I realize how important they are even in the United States, and how many really good questions Americans are asking about them, too. Something like 600 million people live in or near deserts around the world. People have figured out ways to deal with them, either like the people that I lived near, the nomads who herded animals, or like in the American Southwest, who may be retired and living on income from outside, and in California, certainly people that irrigate and are able to farm there. Different systems have been found for living in the deserts, but the main one we're thinking about here, obviously, is the traditional sort of cropping and animal raising patterns that have enabled people to survive in very tough conditions. All right, let me ask now too, we've all heard certainly that deserts are expanding. What is your perception of why the deserts are threatening, or as I was thinking of calling the desert's march, or the process of desertification? Can we name some causes of that?
No, but I mean, I think the combination with the overgrazing and cutting down the trees, I mean, the poor use among people, the expanding population pressures, but like I think in places like Nepal and stuff where they just deforested whole areas and then the desertification process goes in, and certainly some of the areas where you were in, the Sahara is just marching in.
Overuse of the land.
Okay, so we certainly know that a prevailing idea is that desertification comes sort of as the Sahara blows in with a wall of sand, but that's not really the cause, but more poor use of the land. Another really controversial cause is climate. Is the climate changing? Without a doubt, we just went through some really terrible years of drought in sub-Saharan Africa. 68 to 73 was a very serious drought at that point, and then the more recent one in about 1983 and 84 especially was even worse than that one. Very serious periods of drought. And so it certainly seemed that the climate was changing. Possible causes, people advance a lot. The climatologists study this no end, make computer models endlessly to try and figure out. Could have something to do with global warming, but then again there's the warming. which isn't proved, but certainly seems logical given what we know. But from everything that I can read, it's not definite at all. Another possible cause is simply that as we cut down trees, as vegetation decreases, for whatever reason, whether through overgrazing or simply through drought, it always causes more drought because the albedo is increased of the land.
The what?
Yeah, the what?
The reflective power
You guys are so smart, I don't know what word to use. You guys are really smart people. So as it, when it's green, the earth absorbs more sunlight, especially dark green. As it turns to sand colored, lighter colored, it reflects more. This is a theory, it's, that's not proven either. It causes that more reflectivity, meaning more heat rises, meaning the rain is less likely to fall in that place, but will go on to another place where the earth doesn't reflect so much heat.
And this is called albedo.
Albedo is the reflectivity, I think, the factor of. So I read endlessly while I was there, while I was in Senegal, of why things seem to be so much drier. And is it a permanent change or is it not? And the other possible cause forwarded it is simply that the deforestation in areas nearby, for our area, it would be that there's rainforest in all of this area. It's very wet. So as this area gets deforested, something like the Amazon, that could decrease the rainfall much further north. It, they're saying the same things about Brazil. As the rainforest is cutting down, that increases the drought in the northeast because less transpiration from the trees in that area, so less humidity above the arid areas. But everything that I seem to read, from State of the World to all the other articles, say a big maybe for climatic change. Really, we don't know. So we certainly need to look at other causes. And as you guys have very intelligently named, there's deforestation, which affects all sorts of land around the world. It affects the tropical rainforests, as we know, and it affects much, much drier areas. There's overgrazing, and that's certainly the problem I saw the most. And that was very evident in villages where I lived, where where a watering point especially, where thousands of cattle came in, the soil got trampled, and around those points, even when it rained, the grass would not grow again. The seeds are either dispersed, the ground is too trampled down, and there's simply too much activity there for the grass to come back. Over-cultivation of that's of farming areas, obviously is a cause for a lot of reasons that soil can degrade. And we know that even in the American Midwest, where we have a lot of problems with soil erosion, land losing productivity. And the biggest problem is with the topsoil, when the organic matter is lost. And that, of course, makes us think about the Dust Bowl. Now, I was going to ask you, I was thinking maybe there would be people here that know a lot more about the Dust Bowl than me. As a matter of fact, I was trying to read in the library, sort of trying to remember what the causes were and how we sort of got over that. Is there someone here that...
Well, we plowed the prairies, which helped to create the Dust Bowl, and the winds blew, and it really just carried that topsoil. We do it in the Midwest from the Great Plains, and then we had droughts.
It was exacerbated by droughts.
It rained on the 2nd of June, which was my father's birthday, and again in August. The grasshoppers, you couldn't take a step.
Were you there? Where did you live?
In northern Wisconsin, at the Farm in
Yonkers. Oh, even there, it was that
time. Oh yeah, and you sold a cow and got hay for a couple of days.
And what solved it? What brought the end?
The war.
It certainly the depression happened at the same time.
The depression preceded the war.
How is that related to the Dust Bowl?
Not related to the Dust Bowl, but there are cyclic changes. But when it comes to depression, it felt like we were in a Dust Bowl even.
Oh, it probably did have something to do with the economy, though. I mean, the fact that the Dust Bowl was farming, agriculture was a problem then, right?
Okay, they cut down the trees because they were planting, and I don't know if that was during the First World War, they were planting to grow more grain and this type of thing. And that promoted the Dust Bowl days. And they left, the Okies left.
Yeah, the farmers left, they didn't plow anymore in certain areas. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of how it came back.
A lot of places where they left, and it was just return to nature, and I guess the grass died or... Well, the dust down after that, and that we covered a bit.
I think it's good to remember that, and maybe we can all find people that live through it more, because it reminds us that it's not a problem so far away. And I think a lot of the situations that people live through there, small landowners trying to keep their farm, having to cultivate more and more land as it becomes less productive, therefore plowing perhaps really marginal land, and then everything becomes less productive and you've got to find more and more ways to add land, and you're usually adding your worst land then.
Well, and another way that's really hitting close to home right now, not so much in the recent past, but like in the West, in California, and in other places like in Arizona, but particularly in the Central Valley of California, the water table is dropping so drastically from all the over-irrigation, and that's leading to an alkali of the soil becoming much more alkaline, and they're losing vast areas of pretty productive soil and farming areas because of the dropping of the water table, and they're literally mining the water in most of the West as a resource that's a non-renewable resource at the rate it's being exploited. And so we're seeing tremendous problems there as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that is the fourth cause.
Oh.
According, so very good. Poor irrigation practices. And it is striking that a lot of the areas that are most in danger of becoming desert, of desertification on the United Nations Environment Program maps are in irrigated areas. And that whole valley of California is one big black smudge on this one map that I was looking at, which is very striking. The problem, I think, is not so much because of the water table dropping, but rather rising. If you're irrigating continuously and drainage is not adequate, I mean, the water table that you're getting your water out of might be dropping, but you're putting water on the top and it goes down a little bit, but then in times where you don't have water constantly going down, that water will evaporate back up, leaving the salt behind. So a lot of the world's irrigated land is in danger. And that land is very important because obviously much more densely populated than areas like where I was at the edge of the desert where people were traditionally lived over a huge area with their cattle, which could move from one area to another. Well, if a little part gets desertified, it's not so tragic because you move to another part and you're used to doing that. Irrigated land is about 18% of the world's cropland, but produces more than one third of our food. So economically, it's really, really important for us to think of that. California farmers are realizing, I think, with difficulty, that we're not able to solve all our problems. We can't grow food on just any land, and that's hard for us Americans. All right, so the World Watch Institute calls the process of desertification simply land degradation, because desertification sometimes sounds too dramatic, and they were saying it disguises the issue, because it too often conjures up in people's minds this somehow desert blowing in, and we forget about patches like the California Valley, like much of the U.S. or much of Southeast Asia, where land is going out of production, land is ruined, but it's not something so dramatic. Even in areas near the desert, it's not a wall of sand that blows in, but rather, say, a 200-mile stretch south of the desert changes a little bit. Everything changes a little bit. So maybe the edge of the desert, which is already somewhat vague to define, moves a few kilometers south. People started talking a lot about desertification after the 1977 United Nations Conference. United Nations Environment Program Conference on Desertification. And a study done for them before the conference reported that the Sahara Desert was moving south at about 3.5 kilometers a year. So that figure became widely circulated and is probably roughly correct, something like that. But there's a lot of questions about it.
So that's because, about 2 miles, is that?
Yeah, about 2 miles. But it all depends on what year you're measuring. I came to Senegal in a year following a catastrophic year, 1984. I came in the beginning of 1985. Everything was brown. There was not a blade of grass anywhere, not of dried grass, because in the rainy season of 1984, it hadn't rained at all, which hadn't happened in anyone's memory. Nowhere could you find any dried up blade of grass, anything in the ground. It was all like a huge beach. And of course your reaction, well, how can people live here? I mean, we shouldn't be bringing in food aid, people should be moving out. This is clearly uninhabitable land. But miraculously, it rained in 1985. It rained a lot, and on this bare desert sand that looked like a beach, seriously, it did, grass grew, and it grew, and it rained once every week or two is the normal rainfall there, and they got that, a total of about 180 millimeters, maybe, got to transfer that into...
10 inches.
Okay.
Less.
10 inches.
8 inches.
But an adequate amount for grass to grow. And that area, which had seemed like desert, absolutely no question about it, was lush pasture land. And then that grass dries and it's able to support not a huge number of animals, but it's certainly able to support animals. So any data you try and get on desertification...
Pardon, is that sheep and goats or what?
Pardon?
Sheep and goats or what?
Sheep, goats, and cattle.
And cattle.
And a few camels. As the area seems to get drier, camels are becoming more popular, more or less.
That must have just blown you away to watch that after driving.
It was a miracle. It was really a miracle. And it would happen in other years, too. 1989 was the best year they had had in about 30 years. And so grass was everywhere, and even in places that you were sure were degraded beyond hope. But with enough rain, they seem to come back. Well, I don't want to paint a picture of great hope, but it makes you realize how difficult it is to get any statistics on this. I mean, satellite pictures are really interesting, but they depend on time of year, agricultural patterns, everything. They were saying that in one study, the satellite data of parts of Pakistan were wrongly interpreted to be desert, but actually they were very productive rice fields, which happened to be dry at the time the picture was taken. So it's very complicated. So what can we do about this? That is, of course, the question with all these environmental problems. We talked about the Dust Bowl a little bit. None of us are experts in what happened there, but one of the things that the United States does is they have a program called Conservation Reserves where they compensate farmers to take marginal land out of production. Of course, the United States has resources to do that. We're used to compensating farmers for a lot of things. Farm subsidies are a thing that we can afford and something that we can manage. So they say that there's about 15 million hectares put in this program so far. And usually it's allowed to go back to trees, which is, of course, the best use of the land. In developing countries, it's harder to do things like that. As a matter of fact, it's unthinkable in most of them, where countries are struggling to survive. There's very little chance that any country is going to be able to pay its farmers a certain sum for taking their land out of production. They're still putting a lot more new land into production. Some of the examples that seem to work in various parts are making terraces. They're finding easier ways to make terraces because not all countries make those beautiful terraces of Southeast Asia that we've all seen those absolutely exotic pictures of going down hillsides. But even farmland that's on a slope can be helped a lot by either planting grass in rows along the contours, or what they were doing in areas near mine in Burkina Faso was simply laying rows of stone along the contours. And then as the rains come, soil is washed up against those buns that let some of the water through, and they become terraces gradually. I always read that and it sounded so exciting, but my area was so sandy that none of the water seemed to run off anyway. These kind of things seem to work more in clay soils.
Was your area pretty hilly or was it?
No, flat? it was quite flat. But it's amazing how small the slope you still have erosion on. That's often amazing in American agriculture, but it was really flat.
How far were you from Senegal inland?
From the ocean?
Inland from Dakar?
I was about 350 miles from Dakar, but north, so I was about 150 miles maybe from the ocean. But that put us at an elevation of about, I don't know, 20 feet or something like that. The river flowed so slowly down to the ocean. It was a really very flat country. One of the things that we really need to work on are mulching and what they call alley cropping. One of the international research centers in Nigeria is trying to promote the cultivation of a crop called lucena, which you might have heard of. It's been called the miracle tree and all kinds of other things. It came from Hawaii, I think. And it can grow really fast if it has enough moisture. So they're trying to encourage farmers to plant rows of that along the contour again with areas of at least 30 feet between.
Is that a nitrogen fixing tree?
Uh-huh, it's a nitrogen fixing tree. And then what they want the farmers to do is as a regular cultivation practice, chop off what's grown, and then that will just fall down as mulch into the crops. It's a way of increasing the organic matter and obviously the nitrogen too.
And what's it called, lucena?
Mm-hmm. Huh. But it needed a little more water than where I was. We didn't have a lot of variety in what trees we could plant in my poor area there. But in Nigeria and areas around there, I think in Latin America too.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. The one is again the dangers of introducing trees from totally different areas into an area, just introducing any kind of plant like that way. Secondly, a lot of places, like I know in Haiti, they had real problems with the reforestation because people use it, the reforest of trees more, or they use it at a faster rate for firewood. It's the only source of cooking than they allow the trees to grow. So like Haiti was for every, and they were replanting one tree for every 10 that was being felled, and they were not even keeping up with reforestation. Was that a problem with some of the areas you saw in terms of people needing that for other sources and so?
Wood, absolutely. Yeah, in the Sahel, as far as people living there, it seems that the number one factor that's going to limit the number of people that can live there is wood. They say more than food production, more than water, more than anything else, it's wood. Where I was, people didn't really feel the crunch yet. I actually read more than I felt of that because so many trees had died in these two big droughts in the early 70s and then again in the early 80s. There were masses of trees that had died, and so people were still living off that wood a lot. And then they were cutting down trees also much, much faster than they're being planted. But there were still enough trees to do it at this time, but it's going to be a terrible problem. It really is. And all we can do is try and plant more trees.
And already your most popular tree for you to plant is mesquite, which is introduced from the United States, is that right?
Yeah, because it grew so well and grew so fast. The local trees are great, and what most people were trying to do now is grow and protect more of the local trees. But they're very slow growing, the ones in my area. Of course, maybe there's a reason. Maybe it's because fast growing trees can't do well for some reason that we don't see yet. But the mesquite from the deserts of Arizona and Mexico does very well there. And the local acacia trees would take five times longer to grow to the same height. That's why the exotic trees are popular. The lucena, nothing seems to be like it, but what I've heard is they planted it all over the world because it was so great, and now it is being struck by disease, which is of course the classic problem, that there are diseases that we don't know about when you plant too much of any crop, especially introduced ones. They're very susceptible.
I thought I'd read about two American women who devised a simple stove that simply used the sun's reflection and it could be used for both cooking and boiling water and frying and so forth. Have you heard anything about it?
There are a lot of stoves invented. There are very few stoves being used.
Why?
A lot of reasons. Number one, I think with all our experience of subsidize this and subsidize that and inappropriate gifts, the general thought is that any stove that's really going to make it, people have to be able to afford themselves. I mean, you could give them as gifts for sure, but any material that's going to make a stove like that is usually going to include some kind of foils and some kind of materials that are usually out of the reach of the very poor. Also, a problem is that you have to cook when there's sun,
well,
and there's not always sun when you want to cook, and people don't like to change. We all know that, but that may be something that people are simply going to have to accept more of in the future. They're trying in my area more to introduce wood conserving stoves, either ones that are made out of clay that can reduce wood consumption by up to a half, it is said. They don't seem to in practice, usually for whatever reason. Maybe people throw too much wood in there just because they're used to it, and then the fire's too hot and all kinds of problems. But I lived through 5 years of organizations pushing these stoves, and I tried in my little way, very little way, to encourage women to do it. One time in one village, for example, brought the young Senegalese woman who had been trained to teach women to make these stoves in a series of three visits out to one of the villages where I'd been working. And all the women came, and they all made their stoves. And it took a reasonable amount of work, not a ridiculous amount of work, and no material costs, so that was nice. They had to collect manure and clay, which they were already used to doing because they made their houses out of the same material. And then water, it took a lot of water. And then they had to find three stones, which turned out to be the biggest problem, which gives an idea of my area. There were no stones anywhere. Mm-hmm. So people were doing things like little coffee cans. Amazingly, they had more coffee cans than stones, and filling them with sand to use, or anything that they could find, maybe an old cement brick, but there simply are no rocks there. And then a tomato paste can, and that's what they needed to make these stoves. So they all made them, were really happy about them. And then, you know, this woman left, and then they started saying to me, well, where's our gift? Where's our food aid or something for having made these stoves? And I said, well, we never said anything about food aid. You're making these stoves because you have a shortage of wood, and because these stoves are, they have less smoke, and all the reasons that this woman who worked for a forestry program had talked with them about. And they said, well, we don't care about any of those things. We thought we'd get food aid out of it. Huh. So about a year later, she came back with me again. You don't want to take out the grass and plant something else. And so the only thing that can convert grass into something usable by humans are animals that convert it into, especially milk and somewhat for meat. Most of these nomadic societies live much more on milk than on meat. But your family planning is certainly the key of it, the key issue, and this is a tough moral one for me because, you know, we heard some very radical possible solutions last night at the forum of allowing people certificates to have children. But, you know, we value freedom and we value respecting people's cultural traditions. But when people's cultural traditions say your number one goal in life is to increase the size of your ethnic group, that doesn't get the globe too far, Dan.
Well, I of course always tend to think in really large macro kinds of mm-hmm. stuff, but some things have really struck me that following particularly the disappearance of the rainforest, and I think a lot of it, certainly not all, but a lot of it is really tied to first world consumption patterns. And we've gotten used to being able to have winter vegetables and all sorts of things that demand conversion of land in many countries from sustaining their own local population, export cropping, and then people are forced, as I was saying, for sustaining themselves, going farther up into the hillsides, see this in Central America, Latin America a lot, kind of in the rainforest. And also people are, the international economy forces so many of these third world nations into exporting of raw materials and agricultural goods. I remember there was an excellent article or a radio program by NPR on the problem in Borneo with the cutting of the rainforest. And the government there simply said, they said, you know, we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. You tell us that the only way that we can grow, the only way we can economically grow is to tie ourselves into this international system that wants our raw materials and our agricultural exports. Same time you tell us we can't use the rainforest. And so they said that we simply cannot do both of those. Something has to give. If the only way we can economically advance and develop is to tie ourselves in this, where we're exporting our raw materials. The very economic system is forcing us to destroy the natural resources. And I think that there's so much of that, when you lay on top of that, like you were saying, the cultural patterns that each country has. But I just think so key is the lack of economic development in so many of these areas.
Pardon me, what is it?
The lack of economic development, which in many places just forces people to continue to have large families in order to try and survive. I mean, there have been so many cases where they've seen where once you've been able to stabilize in a developing country, the population growth curves tend to fall after that point. But as long as it's economically unstable, they grow tremendously. But I don't know if that makes any sense in terms of what you saw in Africa.
No, it's very different than my situation.
Okay.
But it's important. I mean, land degradation is different in every place, but all of it is important. And people are dependent on the land everywhere. No, I was in an area where there wasn't much export of anything. There was a lot more import of food, and it was never clear to us what people exported. Usually their labor. They went as immigrants somewhere else. That was their means of dealing with the fact that their old economic system no longer worked. So they weren't under pressure for something, but you do need a certain number of animals to live, and the population certainly was growing, and I think that was the problem.
I'm gonna shut that door.
I don't know why it keeps
opening. Every time I shut it, it gets open. I think it's not being shut each time.
I long had the feeling that the Africans, the nomads in the desert and so forth, were really doing well in their own way until we sort of interfered. It may not have been the type of life we wanted to live, but they had a balance with nature that was worthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nomads are fascinating people. And the more I learn about them, I think it's more something I'd like to continue to study. I mean, traditionally these areas had nomadic people, and then they had some settled people. For example, where I was, it'd be right along the river, and then where the river flooded, like the Nile, they could do flood recession farming, and those people could be settled. All around were nomadic people. And the nomadic people all the way around, at least on both sides of the Sahara, were often warlike people, and they often were hated and feared by the settled people, and often had settled people as their slaves. Of course, it's exacerbated if the nomads are white or Arab and the settled people are blacks, and that seemed to be the dominant pattern around there. But still, those nomads had found a way to deal with their impossible living conditions through their animals and through things like trading slaves, trading salt, and having captive people, they managed to live and live just fine. With colonialism, it's generally agreed that the settled people were favored because there were usually head taxes on the nomads, and they never went to school, of course. No nomad is interested in the least in going to school. Besides, even if they were interested, how are they going to do it unless they send their kids to live with somebody settled? So they really lost out under colonialism. And now the settled people have all the power. They're certainly expanding faster. And it's the nomads that have become the marginalized people. In the big droughts, it's them that lost everything. Because of course, farmers, if you somehow manage to get through the years of drought, once it rains again, you can go back to your old pattern. If you're a nomad who lives on animals, you've probably lost your herds, and then you're wiped out. It's like a farmer who's lost his land, you've lost all your capital. One of the most moving evenings I can ever remember was one time when we were on a, well, it was my first year, I think that's why it was so moving, and we had, we were driving from where I lived to 100 miles south of there, and when we started out, it was just sort of sprinkling, and so we thought, no problem. Besides, it was my first year, and I didn't know how impossible this desert where I lived was when it rained. I thought it's sandy, the sand will get harder, and it'll be no problem. Well, it turned out that 50 miles to the south of us, they had had this huge rainstorm. This was the end of the drought in early 1985, and it had rained 100 millimeters, which is what, 4 inches in one night. And nobody was going anywhere. It was just utterly flooded. So we were in the hands of people there. Well, luckily we, you know, I mean, if there was no possibility of going on, we had to spend the night. So we spent the night with somebody who we found to spend the night with. But this guy happened to be a very well-educated herder, fortunately, because my pular was no good at that time. I was working on it, but not to the level which I could really have a good conversation. So we spoke in French. But he told the story of how he had gone south, as all the herders had, and when it had not rained where he lived, he had to take the cattle south. Well, then all the herders from the north are down in the south too, so the people down there are not happy at all. They don't want their grass eaten up by the people from the north, so they're shunned by those people. They're shunned by the government workers, who consider them lowly anyway. They're shunned by everybody, and you had to sleep outside. You had to walk your animals probably 10 miles a day to try and get water and to try and get grass. And it was just a hellish existence. It sounded so awful. And he had gone through 9 months of that. And now, you know, thanks be to God, it had started raining again. Nomad's life is very tough, very, very tough. And it's certainly a culture that we don't want to lose, because it is the most responsible way of dealing with these patchy rainfall kind of areas. But who would ever want to do it once you see another way of life? Who would want to go back to it? And besides, you're easily wiped out. So I think that's the question. Nomads are people that we need to learn a lot more about, and we need to make sure that they get their fair share in government today. You brought up a good point, and I think that's one of the main solutions that we need to work for desertification, that often people, when they don't have secure hold on their land, they have to go to do things that you wouldn't want to do, move on to marginal land, for example. Where I was, the related issue is that people, if people don't have rights to their own trees, they're not going to plant trees. And where I am, it's less a problem of land tenure, because the land isn't all that valuable. People are unlikely to take it away from them. Who would want it? You can't grow something for export export on it. But the forestry officials through the years have decided that trees are so valuable that people don't have the right to cut down their own trees. Well, if people don't have the right to cut down their own trees, they're not going to plant their own trees, because they'll still have to go somewhere else for firewood. So they're just thinking about changing the laws in Senegal and in a lot of the Sahel to give people the rights over trees that they've planted to cut them down whenever they think.
That's what that's what they ended up finding out was the only way they started working in Haiti, was letting the people, because before they couldn't cut them down and it wasn't working at all. And then when they finally gave people the control over their own resources, then the people had a vested interest in maintaining them.
So, and obviously secure land tenure, wherever they are, is an important thing. For the irrigated land, what are we going to do about that land in California to save it? Are we going to give it up?
Well, drip irrigation takes a lot less water than spray.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know about the canal irrigation.
No, drip takes less than anything. But I think in California, you know what it relates to? It's like the signs that are up all over here at Holden. Of the reason you can't flush your toilet is we have plenty of water, but we have to reduce the amount of water that we put in the drainage fields. And I wonder if it isn't more like that. At least some of the waterlogged areas. I recently heard a speech on the situation in Pakistan, and that's certainly the situation. They've got enough water in these huge canals, but they just cannot get rid of it. You can dig drainage canals, but Yeah, I'll just tell you about the situation in Pakistan because it was so fascinating, and I couldn't even figure it out. The water, when the canals were built, there was no drainage put in. Okay, so they have this problem that they're waterlogged, and how to get rid of the water and drain it out. So
okay,
what they decided
the water
to do
coming for the canals
from mountains a long ways away, but that didn't seem to be the problem. The problem was that the water was getting too salty, which I think is the same problem in California. So what they started to do was to dig two wells, deep wells, down into the aquifer, which was being recharged by these huge canals, bringing the water up from deep down, maybe 50 feet down, it's not that deep, but anyway, a ways down, and putting extra water on the land so that it would go on down through into the area below the cropped area, but above the aquifer, sort of filling up that dead land in there where there wasn't water in storage, but it also wasn't cropland, and getting all the salts down into that area. I thought it was an amazing system. They simply couldn't figure out any other way to get rid of those salts, because it was an area of Pakistan where it was far enough from the ocean that they couldn't drain it down into the ocean because of you would have had to go through mountains and I don't know what to get to the ocean. They couldn't go into India because of political problems where they could have possibly drained it out, so they were stuck. Drainage is very tricky. Even if engineering-wise you can figure out how to drain your fields, you got to have somewhere to drain it to.
But isn't that in California, isn't that really only half the problem as well? I mean, it is a source of water the other half of the problem.
Yeah, especially water that comes from the rivers.
Because there's so much controversy over the drain or damming for the rivers. And,
they
pump so much of the water from the north down to the south for agriculture and into the LA area. So it's become a big political debate there as well. It's so complicated because not to harp on that point again, but I think so much of it does come to lifestyle demands. We've created this enormous demand for the kind of agriculture that California can produce with very intensive irrigation. And now it's an incredible business. I think California produces roughly 25% of the agricultural products consumed in the United States alone. And yet it's not sustainable. And yet the state economy, a lot of it is built on it. And so it really is a difficult situation.
Is your perception that the water users, the agricultural users, are paying less than the cost of water?
Oh, far, far less, yeah. I mean, they're by far the majority users. Well over 90% of the water is used in agriculture. And what's getting people are getting so angry now, like in Northern California, they have water rationing all the time because the water is drained from their areas. Their drainage systems are pumped to the agricultural areas into Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles Basin owns the water rights to most important California, and so it gets pumped over the mountains, and they use enormous amounts of energy to pump it.
Pardon me, Basin owns the water rights?
Los Angeles, the LA County and the city obtained the water rights in the early part of the century, so it's...
Well, and maybe in the end it'll be the land degradation that stops it. If there isn't a political will to say we can't irrigate those areas once they're too salty, too alkaline, mm-hmm. or whatever the chemical problem is, maybe that's what'll stop it. Terrible solution, though. It's a terrible... Yeah, I guess the reason I said that is because I'm thinking of land degradation. The problem is the drainage.
Yeah, I think that's the immediate problem in California, or it's beginning to be in a section of about a sixth of the Central Valley, I think. A friend of mine had done some reporting or photographing in the area and said that he had to put on a mask in order to go into the area because it was so toxic. I can't remember exactly what the, it was. But it was the problem you described, the drainage, and there's a level, the soil is such that the water doesn't...
Because I don't know how they irrigate. You irrigate the roots. It's the most efficient way.
Mm-hmm.
You have to drip the roots into the roots. It doesn't even drip on the ground. It's piped evidently down in the roots.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether they're using their water efficiently.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I can't imagine
that
they adopted this method.
I read that one of the maybe controversial. I forget which organization is promoting, one of the nature conserving organizations is promoting the possibility that cities buy some of the farmers' water rights. And through that influx of cash, the farmers would be able to put in drip irrigation, which of course is very capital intensive, very expensive to start out. I don't know what other people think about that. It seemed to be really controversial because other nature people were saying, you know, environmental people were saying, you know, let's not even talk about buying water rights. The cities don't need more. Let's just leave it in Mono Lake or whatever. So we don't need more. But anyway, that those technologies obviously could go in. But it's one of those questions. Is there a technology that's going to solve the problem, or do we simply have to change the whole pattern? And anything that stops jobs, that stops economic input, is not very popular.
Is there an incentive even for them to use less water? Seems to me I've heard or read, no, that there's something that they get more water if they use more water.
Yeah.
Or there's no incentive to use less.
But if the cost of the water are raised, so they pay the full cost of it, or even more than the full cost of it, then there'd be a lot of incentive to use it efficiently.
Well, we'll work towards those solutions. I guess in summary for the problems of land degradation in Africa, especially where I was, I remember Lester Brown saying very briefly, what we need to do is plant families and plant trees. And both very difficult solutions, but...
Did you say plant or plant families?
Plan families and plant
trees. But you said
trees.
We. But you said we. Who are we?
The world. We, humanity.
You cannot plan their families, unfortunately.
No. Any last comments?
I'm just curious about your own plans for your education now. Will you be dealing with some of these programs or problems? Are you?
Yeah, that's what I hope. That's certainly my goal, because I think we can change our lifestyles and make smarter policies, but maybe, just maybe, there are smarter ways to apply technologies that would help figure out some of the problems. I mean, those drainage problems fascinate me. What can you do with that water? The tailings, that's one of my current things that I think about. You know, what are we doing with that? All kinds of there are improved technological solutions. It's agricultural engineers that came up with drip irrigation. Well, that's helped some areas. Maybe it hasn't as helped as much as we'd like. But some things can be accomplished through technology. So that's what I'm studying.
Of course, there is desalinization. If the Middle Eastern countries can do it, why can't LA?
Of water?
No.
Next week, I'm thinking of talking more about water. I mean, it's sort of a different problem, water supply.
Yes, but of course, the water supply has something to do with what's going to happen to the land.
Yeah, exactly. They're linked.
How much you're using.
Okay, thank you. It's 5:00.
Boy, as always, it's a good session. We end up with about 50 more questions at the end than when you started. I think that my mind is rolling out things.
But what group were you with?
When I was in Africa, with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Who were you with?
Department of State.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
In the Foreign Service?
So you worked in Bamako?
That was one. Bamako, Lagos, those are only two places in Africa, in Asia. Mostly in the third world.
Very interesting.
What area of state were you foreign or political?
Foreign Service. I was a nurse.
Nurse? Any time in America or?
Rio once. So. They took it out of care for Rio. All the young men left.
Yeah.
The noisiest city I've lived in.
No, I've noticed you asking a lot of good questions. It certainly comes out of people that have been there.
How big a concern do we have there?
How big?
how big a concern is that there are the evangelical Lutheran church? And what's the...
How many people do we have?
Yeah, and what is the past, the history of it? What synod did it belong to?
It was the ALC before, started in about 1975.
Okay, ALC, American Lutheran Church, mm-hmm. Which was which background?
How far do you want to go back?
Well, I always get mixed up.
It was the Norwegians, the ELC, got together with the Germans, wasn't it? The ULC, well, are they the Danes?
But
and
the,
one of
the
Danes,
Danes the Germans, the Swedish, and the Suomis got together.
Okay, that's not that one.
It's not that one. Okay.
The other kind of Danes, I think the sad
the
Danes.
The holy Danes.
Okay, the holy days are the sad days.
I'm
yeah.
a happy days.
You're a happy day, okay.
But anyhow, and that was in 75, they established it.
Well, then we went to Senegal.
Yeah.
Of and course, now there are five families. It's not big. It's not big. And we're all living in the north of the country.
And
what's
Dakar. The main the thrust of the.
Different kinds of development work. We have an urban center in Dakar. Where there's a library and all kinds of urban outreach of over 2,000 members. And then I was working with gardens with women, especially and reforestation, tree planting in the north. Now there's somebody that's working with animals. He's an animal scientist, specialist in goats. And then we have health people. We've had several nurses through the years working in primary health care. It's tough, huh? And the solutions that people seem to come up with are simple, but people don't want them. That's the problem.
Well, for instance, the French built some great wells in Mali. And the Malians thought the French were going to maintain. And French said, no, they're your wells to maintain. So the Malians went back to that little hole in the ground where anyone could fall in, like a child or an animal or what, as opposed to the cement collared big wells that evidently they needed to clean every so often.
To step in.
But
that's really unsettling.
It's just because.
You
just
so
feel defeated. I get so tired of hearing about the starving in Africa that I feel like I just want to turn that page or turn off that TV. And part of it is because of our measles and smallpox immunizations that we did across the whole of Africa. So they live longer and die of starvation.
Well, once I get some
ownership, you try to truck food into Chad, and so who takes the food? But AID was trucking food up to Chad. When it got to the border, it had to be transported by this old fleet of trucks, which turned out belonged to the president's wife. And of course, it never really reached the tribes it was meant for because they were the rebellious tribes, and why should you feed the ones you're fighting and killing off? That doesn't make any sense. And it gets sold along the way and depleted.
Exactly. It's amazing, Al, how tough it is. You don't always think it's going to be so tough. You think with the money put, your heart is in the right place and your money is in the right place. Some lot of work, but it doesn't always. It really is tough.
I know a friend of mine who was in relief work in the Lutheran Church, Lutheran World Relief, I believe. And he retired. They called him out of retirement because he was well thought of to go to Biafra, go to Nigeria just during the Biafran War. So the first thing he had to do was to shovel all the rotten grain into the ocean and try to get things moving thereafter. But of course, the Biafrans, the Nigerians weren't interested in feeding the Biafrans.
Absolutely not.
And I just get so discouraged about it.
Yeah, I think for anyone who's seen realistically the situation, it's very hard not to get discouraged, you know. I have that problem a lot myself. That's one of the reasons why I'm here.
Starving Africans or starving Asians or whatever.
So there are plenty of Americans who are hungry.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, you just have, you know, you can't have any illusions about people somehow being good because they're poor. They're just poor, but they can be as evil as the next person. There's always good people and bad people in every society. And in Africa, much of Africa right now, it's the bad people that seem to have the power. That's the problem, is they take power.
But they were talking about the cost of housing and how high it's gone, of course, and that the young people can't buy it today. But I know that those young people, they will go out to eat, and they will buy fast foods and junk foods that I would never think about. They will spend their money in ways that I would find very difficult to do.
That's what happened on lunch.
Yeah, I think that's generally right.
And so on the one hand, I feel badly for them. But on the other hand, I think, well, so
they're making
even McDonald's costs quite a bit these days.
It'll be the same for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to wait until I get a sense.
And potato chips aren't that great of food either.
And I'll put the...
All these soda pops, my God. That's what we want to bring to the third world country.
Well, let's hope we don't want to bring that.
Well, that's what's there.
Yes, unfortunately, it's there.
Yeah, unfortunately.
That's what our corporations take there.
Yeah, that may be what Coca-Cola Corporation wants.
Well, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, what is it they call it in India? They have some cola drink which they fashion to sort of simulate Coca-Cola, the Russians are letting it in, the Japanese are getting fat on our fast foods, which they never were before.
We got a lot of work to do. Can't figure out what we're going to do about it, but there's work to do.
Oh, God.
But somehow, that's why you come to Holden, I think, to get revitalized and find there's other people, and that there's hope somehow. I mean, there's got to be a hope that we don't see.
Well,
every day is very discouraging.
I used to think that there was hope in getting something done about the family planning.
Well, there is. Some of the countries have really reduced their...
Yeah, but we have backed off on it considerably.
Yeah, that's a problem. In Senegal, there's kind of good news, because where I was, they were starting really slowly. It was a totally U.S.-backed plan, amazingly. And they purposely went slowly because I knew people from the time I got there in 85. But just now in the early 1990, finally a trained midwife came to my village and settled in there. Well, very slowly, no, actually in the end of 89. And very slowly, at first nobody wanted to go, but I just sort of asked people. Nobody wanted to talk about it out loud or anybody, but sort of through word of mouth, slowly people were going. And most of the women wanted it, but were afraid to talk about it. I mean, it was not acceptable, but it was kind of popular. And I think because it was so subtly introduced, I think it's gonna do all right in that village. Among the more thinking women anyway, people that can see, they're all gonna try and get something, and it's all free. So that's good.